Hello, and welcome to the American Midwife Series podcast. I'm your host, Angelica Malone, and today's episode is focused on telling the story of an American midwife legend and her work in addressing the disparities in Black maternal child health through ICTC, the International Center for Traditional Childbearing. Shafia Monroe is a legendary midwife of more than 36 years. She's a wife, mother, author, president of Doula Ready LLC, owner of Shafia Monroe Consulting, and founder of ICTC, which is now the National Association to Advance Black Birth. Ms. Shafia has been a midwife since 1978, walking alongside thousands of families. She's an expert in serving diverse populations in maternal child health. She's also a motivational speaker who provides professional development, cultural competency, and doula trainings around the world. So, I did just share with everyone a little bit about you, your background, how long you've been doing midwifery, but I would love to offer you the opportunity to share in your own words who you are.
I hesitate. I just came from the Midwives Alliance of North America on November 1st, 2019, receiving the Lifetime Achievement Award, which is the third award they've ever given in 50 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I mentioned that because they read who I was and it was two pages long. It was very emotional, very beautiful how they described me. So I don't say a lot about myself personally. I say I'm a midwife, I'm a healer, I'm a mother, I'm a wife. But they said I was a great leader. I was the cornerstone of midwifery. I was a person they could work with, you know, in the midwifery world, helping to look at reducing racism in the midwifery work, as well as, of course, reducing infant maternal mortality and a lot of other things. So I'm going to own that because I think that is what I do. And that's and all that. The reason why I do that, because that is what we need in order to uplift the legacy and our contribution as African descent people to midwifery in America. And that's what we need to bring the profession together to know that all communities have a stake in this profession. It belongs to everyone. So that's what I do. But the fun part that I do has been to actually catch babies. And I say catch, not deliver. The fun part has been I've been able to help families have their babies in the home. And now I've moved to helping doulas think about midwifery as a profession. And if not, at least practice being a doula like a 20th century African-American midwife, which means that that person, that midwife of that era, she was very well-rounded. She came to your house. She knew you. But the part I like is that she did. She actually loved the people that she served. And she loved them. She understood them. She knew them. She came after the babies were born. She taught the entire family. And so that's what I do. I'm an educator. I'm a historian. I'm a herbologist. Boy, I want to say I'm a dancer.
Just call it. Say it how you want. Say it what you are.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to. I love that. I agree completely and wholeheartedly with what they said about you, that you are a leader and that you are the cornerstone of midwifery in this country, especially Black midwifery and reducing infant and maternal mortality. I would completely agree. And that's actually one of the reasons why I really wanted to talk with you, because as I journey along my journey to becoming a midwife, that is one of the things I'm really passionate about, making sure that it's addressed. But you can't really go forward until you go back and you pay homage and you see where people who have come before you have already gone and what they've already done. There's no reason for me to try and do something that's already been done. So I want to hear from you. I want to hear your background. I want to know where you came from. I want to hear your words of wisdom. So before we get started, can you just take us back to where your midwifery journey began? Where are you from? Where did you grow up? What was the call for you to midwifery?
So, you know, I answer that question in different ways. So I'm going to answer it this way. I believe that anyone who's a midwife, first of all, was called at inception. I do believe that. I do believe that when I hear that the 20th century African-American midwives were called to the world, that's the word they use. It wasn't preferred. They were called, you know, by the creator. And that's so well documented through dreams and all kinds of different things. But for me, I was called very early because I wanted to be a vet when I was little. And I've seen horses born and puppies and kittens. And that's what I wanted. I always wanted to help the animals. And I feel that was preparing me to help humans. Mm-hmm. And so I lived, my mother died when I was 14, and I moved in with, I became Muslim when I was 15, and I moved in with a Muslim family. Her name was Ahada Yusuf. She was having her fourth baby. I had never been around really a pregnant woman, and she was very open to her body, so I got to see her stomach grow. And I remember just like loving her, and I'm 16, and just following her, always sitting next to her, you know, and giving her water. And so, and I just want to feel the baby move, and she would let me. And then she gave me a book called Emergency Childbirth for Fathers. It was a little paperback, and I read that book, you know, inside and out. I memorized that book, actually. And then she had a baby, and I was surprised that she didn't call me. She went to the hospital. Back then, it was hospital births. And she had a baby. She came home, and I remember seeing her stomach. She got undressed in the room one day, and I was surprised that, you know, I didn't know that you still look pregnant after the baby's born. And she wore a girdle. They didn't wrap the stomachs, but, you know, you, at that era, you put the girdle on, which is a, how do I say it? Like another phase of the traditional wrapping. They went from the wrapping to putting the girdle on. So she put her girdle on. And then, you know, I asked a lot of questions. Then I left her home and went back to my father's house. And as I was living there and in school, I heard about infant mortality. And I researched it and found out that it meant that babies die before age one. And I was like totally upset about that. What do you mean babies are dying like before one? Like why? And no one really knew why. And so I started researching more why. And when I was researching that why, I came across midwives. And that's how I began learning about the African-American midwife, because I had never heard about midwives before. You know, I knew doctors and obstetricians, but not midwife, and definitely not Black midwives. So I was so excited to read about them, because all about everything that I knew, you know, they were from down south. My family's from down south. I go down south, you know, we eat grits and cornbread and, you know, the greens. And so it was just so nice to read about them and how amazing they were. And I just wanted to emulate what they did, because I felt if they could do that under very hard conditions of enslavement and post-enslavement and legal segregation, you know, what could I do in the North with access to things, you know?
Yes.
And so I wanted to be like them. So now it's like, how do I become a midwife? Because nobody knows any midwives around at all. So I have two ways of doing this. One is that I did start college, University of Massachusetts, to do, to take pre-med, but I still wanted to be a midwife. I couldn't find a midwife. So I would stand on campus and ask people who went by, particularly African women. First I asked about my community. Does anyone know any midwives? And everybody said, no, you know, no, we don't. And then I would ask people on the campus. And finally, a woman from Uganda said that she was a midwife. I'm like, oh, you know, you have to help me. I have to be a midwife. You know, Black babies are dying. I need to do this. And she was kind of hesitant for a little while. But after a while, she's like, okay. She told me to come to her house. And I did. She had all her books out. And she tried to teach me about the uterus. And I had not taken any biology yet. And also, I didn't tell that I left high school. After my mother died, I dropped out of school. So I didn't even get all those classes in high school. And so I couldn't quite figure it out what she was talking about. And somehow, I believe I stopped going, perhaps. But there was a good introduction for me. And also, at the same time, I did join the Massachusetts Midwives Alliance. It just started because midwifery is coming back in the 70s. And this is 1974, I think. I had no children yet because I had my first baby in 1976. So I had no children yet. And so we're just getting started with the movement on the East Coast anyways. And so the Massachusetts Midwives Alliance formed, same thing with, you know, women wanting to learn to be midwives. We met in people's houses. It was called Newton, a very nice town outside of Roxbury, a suburb. I was the only, you know, Black person there. Not only was I the only Black person there, I was the only person who didn't have children. I was also the only person who was under the age of 20. So everybody else was married, you know, mature women with children. So I was totally like not even fitting in there fully. But they were open and they, you know, come. But after going for a few times, I think I made about five times. We did the pelvic exam on each other, and we read and we talked and did things that to start teaching ourselves. Because back then, you know, everyone was learning on their own, like homeschool midwifery class. But I just felt from the conversation that at some point, because I was hearing them about, you know, doing births and things like that, I'd probably get into a birth. And I also felt that I'm coming out from Roxbury, a Black community, going into a white suburb to learn. And I wanted to make sure that I could also create something in my own community. And that was like a catalyst, like, hey, Shafia, just, you know, go create your own thing. And so that was my goal. And then I got married, I got pregnant, looking for a Black midwife, couldn't find one. So I found a white physician. I talked to other doctors, by the way, even of color. I'm like, no, we're not doing a home birth for you. Like, you're crazy. Are you kidding? and I kept looking. I found Muslim doctors, Black doctors, like, no, are you, no way. And I said, well, you know, I'm having a baby home without you all. And I kept looking. And finally, someone told me about Dr. Elia Older, a Jewish doctor, and of all things, even a male doctor, but I didn't care. Yeah. And he was very nice, and he came to my house. I remember laying in the bed, my husband on one side of the bed, and I had met a labor and delivery African-American nurse at Boston City Hospital. We became friends, and her name was Rahima, actually. And she came to my house, and she sat by my side, a doula back then, without the word. She sat by my side. She never left me the whole time. And it's so funny because, you know, now that I'm trained, of course, I'm like, get up, walk around, squat, push down. I lay in that bed on my back, mind you, lifting me position for 24 hours. I don't think I even went to the bathroom. But and then, wow. And the thing is, I never said a word. I just laid there. And then he must have heard me make a sound, like a pushing sound, maybe. And he came and said, okay, it's time to push. And so he said, but don't, you know, I'll tell you when. He said, okay, don't push now. But I just kept pushing. I said, I'm just going to get this baby out. So I had a little boy. He was gorgeous, 7 pounds, 8 ounces. I couldn't believe it. Just so beautiful. So very excited. He was very much wanted and loved and appreciated. He was a wonderful person, wonderful experience. So that was my home birth. And I'm still not a midwife, but still learning, you know, on my own, studying with people here and there. But then he told me at a home visit, a postpartum visit, by the way, I helped another African-American lady have her baby like 6 weeks ago. I said, oh, why? I said, I need to know her name. He said, I'll get it. And he did. He gave me her name. Her name was Majida Amadadi. She's still living. She's in Birmingham, Alabama. I called her immediately, and we both screamed, like, oh, my God. Like, yeah, we both had babies, same doctor. Both were midwives, wanted to be midwives, wanted to form something. I went immediately over to her house with my little baby, and it was on. We just, like, you know, and the good part was that my other part of my journey is that when I left the Massachusetts Midwives Alliance, I also went to Boston City Hospital to become a certified nurse's aide, which is a 6 weeks course, but it was good because you learn blood pressures and temperatures and, you know, in and output, how to move people's bodies so you don't hurt yourself and some other things. And they actually put me on the postpartum floor. I had asked for labor and delivery. I didn't get it. I was upset that I didn't get it, but, you know, years later, I was grateful because I spent 1 year 11 to 7 sitting in women's rooms who just had babies but no one to talk to, and they would just give me all their stories, and I learned so much. And, you know, in Boston City is very diverse. That means I had Puerto Rican women, white women, Chinese women, Haitian women, African women. I mean, everyone's there. They all had different stories. It was just amazing. And bringing their baby to them, they got a chance, you know, they breastfed. I had to bring the baby from the nursery to them. I also learned how to do circumcisions there. I learned how to move extra digits. I used to read people's charts. So it was a very good foundation for being a community midwife. So that was also helpful. Majida was already a registered nurse when I met her. Her mother had been a midwife. So she actually worked with her mom. So she had a lot more skills than I did. So she's like, oh, we can do this. And we just got together and called some other friends over in my living room. We said, let's all think of a name. We thought of the word traditional childbearing. We voted. We pulled out of a hat or a bag. And that's the name that won. We formed our nonprofit, and we made flyers, and we used Jeremiah High School, which is a high school for girls, and they allow us to use their cafeteria on the weeknight. And once a week, we gave free childbirth classes for 6 weeks. So we started doing childbirth classes, and then from there, those same women want their babies at home with their partners, and we just would just go catch, you know, we did the formal. We went to the houses and we took their blood pressure. We did regular prenatal care, and they would call us when they went into labor, and we would both show up and we would help the baby come out, and we would stay there and clean up and, you know, rub the back and make the visits afterwards and sign the birth certificate. It was wonderful.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
So when you guys started the traditional childbearing group and you were offering these childbirth classes, but then you were also attending people in labor at their house, did you get any pushback from the community? What was it like? How did the community receive you? How did the other midwives from that Massachusetts Midwives Alliance, how did they perceive you guys? Did they ever say anything?
The Black community thought it was amazing. We were very busy. We were doing, like, you know, four births a month, you know, so busy. people passing, you know, words of mouth by word of mouth. We got very active with the Nation of Islam. We became their midwives. Mm-hmm. But for Temple Number 11, the Sunni Orthodox Muslims, they also wanted home births. Your basic conscious Black women wanted home births. So it was just a good time in history. So with no pushback from the community. Mm-hmm. I got pushback from my own father, though, when I went to have my baby at home. He's like, you shouldn't be doing it. He himself, born in Alabama, 1913, born at home, as was his sister in anybody else in that neighborhood. He was not for it. But as I think I mentioned with others, that he came from a time that's when they were just beginning to degrade midwives. Yes. He grew up in an era saying that midwives were no good. They were dangerous. It was bad. So he mm-hmm. got brainwashed with all that. So he's like, you know, why would you want to do that? And I've heard all my life that this is a scary, bad thing.
Yeah.
So I said, Dad, that was a fib. It was a wonderful thing. And that's propaganda. So I'm going to have my baby at home. So, and this is a really funny story. So my sister gets pregnant because we're still learning. I need someone to get some more experience with. She gets pregnant after me. So I said, you should have your baby at home. She lived at my dad's house. And my dad said, no way she have my baby in this house. She has to go to the hospital. So, but then my dad gets sick. And he has to go to the hospital. So then my sister goes into labor. I'm supposed to bring him to the hospital with me and Majita, but we wind up eating pancakes. And before we know it, she's having the baby. So she wound up having a home birth.
And you attended her. You were her midwife.
I was.
Oh, my goodness.
My little niece, Jasmine.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, we're eating pancakes. And she said, I remember being against the wall in labor, in pain, and you all sitting there eating pancakes like nothing's going on, just eating and laughing, looking at me, so you're doing good.
Wow.
I think subconsciously, I wanted her to have that baby at home, obviously. Of course. Right?
You're like, look, you're healthy, you're strong. I'm a good wife. Why
Dad's not
here?
Right, and Dad ain't home. We can do it. Typical kids.
He's in the hospital.
Right. So he took it pretty good. He took it pretty good when he looked at me and said, you. So, well, I was always a hard-headed child of the seven siblings. I always was the one on the cutting edge of doing things. So he just looked at me.
Mm. Where are you in rank order in the seven?
I am the fourth from the top.
Okay. I want to ask you a question. Back when you were talking about the community you were serving there in Boston, this is in Boston, Massachusetts, or mm-hmm. outside of Boston. You were saying you were serving a large community of Black families, Nation of Islam, Muslim families. It sounds like they were just waiting for somebody to meet the call. When I listened to the story, it sounds like they were just people already waiting and wishing that there was someone to attend to them at home. Were you having to convince them, or they were just like, once you told them what you do, they were on board?
They were pretty much on board, because you remember, this is like during the 70s. We just got through the Civil Rights Movement. We're hearing about Tuskegee. Women, mm-hmm. women are having horrible stories from the hospital. That, you know, you think it was bad now, it was worse then.
Yes.
You know, doctors had no respect for women, period, particularly Black women. We're at the teaching hospitals, Boston being the mecca of institutions of learning. So they're like, yes, my last experience was horrible. And we're all about self-determination and do for self. And that was a term. It was Black power, self-determination, do for self. And do for self meant you had your baby in your own environment with Black midwives under your own authority and protection. And that's how we did it. A lot of Black men did not want white doctors, particularly men, touching their wives and women. Yes. So that was their piece. So it was it had a lot more political pull in it. So it was a lot easier. And then you had the Muslims who were spiritual saying that, you know, this is natural. And again, Muslim women wanting to have the privacy, they were glad they could be home without having to be exposed to men. No, mm-hmm. no, guaranteed it would not be a male doctor. So all the different philosophies, you know, the Muslims want privacy, you got the revolutionary, you know, don't touch my woman, you know, mm-hmm. and you got women saying that I trust my body and I don't want that bad experience again. I'd rather be home. And so, yeah, it was easy.
Yeah. It was like a perfect, like not really a storm, but just like a perfect mixture of all the needs being met by these Black home birth midwives.
Right. And then we trained, it started with me and Majita, but once we, you know, organized, we had about probably five other women that started coming to births. Some came and didn't stay, but mm-hmm. We had about five of us doing births out there.
Okay. And yeah. You guys had a doctor helping you with the training. Is that right?
Well, no, we trained ourselves, but then I had a doctor from Morocco, a female, who helped us. We ran a midwife school And so,
okay.
Yes, they helped teach. Well, we had doctors. There were doctors who supported all midwives in Boston. You always had your friendly doctor.
Okay.
So doctor, I think his name was Leo, if I can remember. Someone, we had moms with retained placenta. We could bring her to him instead of going to the hospital, and he would help, you know, things like that.
Wonderful. Wow. So you guys are doing your thing there in Boston, attending people in birth, meeting this critical need, training people to become midwives, and then you moved to Oregon. So tell me about that. Tell me what prompted you to move across the country. What was that transition like for the birth community there?
Right, right. So I want to say that I did serve as the home birth midwife in Roxbury for 16 years nonstop.
So, okay, so it was a long time.
Yes, I was 16 years. What did I do? I had, I think, 5 children during that time and a few miscarriages. So I have a lot of pictures of me doing births with babies on my back.
Ms. Shafia?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. So you did 16 years as a home birth midwife in Roxbury. You had 5 children there, all at home?
Yes.
All at home, and you're bringing your babies to birth, and then you had a transition where you moved across the country. And as much as you've done amazing work while you were there for those 16 years, you've done just as much phenomenal, if not more phenomenal, work here on the West Coast. So tell me about that transition and what brought you over here to Oregon.
Okay, I'm going to tell you what brought me over, but I want to say that I believe that my work in Boston prepared me for the work on the West Coast when I formed the International Center for Traditional Childbearing. Okay. So it's like the apprenticeship model of midwifery. You know, everything's a step that leads to the next step. And so I formed TCB in Boston because of the same reason. There were no Black midwives to help me have my baby, and wanted to organize a movement in Boston. So I took that same concept to the East Coast, and I made it international. We're a local nonprofit. So the International Center for Traditional Childbearing formed 1991 in Portland, Oregon, really came about the same reason. Well, a few of the same reasons. One is that I drove cross country 8 months pregnant and came to Portland, Oregon, and could not find the Black midwives. I just went to that in Boston, like, oh, can't find a Black midwife here. So my friend, who's a midwife, Ayana Ade, she actually flew up from Texas to help me have my baby. So at least I knew Black midwives, but just not in Portland. I had tons of, Makita, so many midwives in Boston, in New York. But she flew in from Texas, so we were friends. And she helped me have my little Isaiah, as I mentioned to other people, born unplanned, my first water birth, my only water birth. I'm in the tub, and I'm like, I'm not going to get out. And I remember there was so much meconium, I thought he was born in the swamp, literally. So that water turned black or dark green, and he came out. He was born through the lagoon. So, I came in for personal reasons, and personal reasons around family and relationships, things like that. And I had never thought to come to Portland, to be honest. And I left all my family, and I left TCB actually.
Yeah.
To come out here. And so I have no regrets, because from here, I was able to launch, an international, especially a national movement to really bring Black midwives from around the world. We brought them literally from around the world. They came from Ghana. They came from Nigeria. They come from Colombia. They came from Haiti. They came from Trinidad. They came from Canada. They were all hungry, like, oh my God, we have something that's about us. As they say, by us, for us, and about us. It was all that. And everybody around the country and in the world was looking for something they could be proud of, that said that Black midwives were the bomb. We were the rock. We had it going on, and not this second standard, like, these dirty Black midwives who kill people and all those horrible stories and lies they said about us. We rejected that and came from a whole, came with the truth.
Yeah.
And people appreciated that, and that's why I did. I wanted your generation, my generation, generations come, that midwives of African descent have always been amazing, reputable, skilled, passionate women, predominantly women. There, of course, there are male midwives, I've met many, but majority of women, and that was our calling. So I wanted to put something in place for us, and that came through the International Center for Traditional Childbearing. It also meant working with organizations who were historically predominantly white, built for themselves, having a lot of the influence, because they're the ones that, when they eradicated the, first of all, they eradicated all midwives, including yes. white, you know, but we were the last to eradicate because of segregation. That was our protection, is why we have a better memory than white immigrant women, the Italians, the Irish, mm-hmm. All of them, they got the midwifery taken a lot earlier than we did in this country. But they then came back, as we know, as nurse midwives, and they became the midwife, and we yes. were just totally out the picture. And again, coming from do for self, that was not okay with me. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to have to be who I am, the revolutionary human being that the Creator made me to be, to say we have to organize around that. And I'm not giving myself credit because, as I mentioned, Ayanna Ade, Saran Henderson, there are so many other groups that were also forming in their own state. And I did create a Black midwife timeline on the ICTC. And literally, we listed every single year and list of things happening, including the first Black midwifery school in Tuskegee, what year that was, the second Black midwife school. Both closed within a year, but we have Black midwife schools.
Wow, I did not know that. I would yeah. love to know more about those. Ms. Shafia, I want to ask you a question really quick. When you first got to Oregon and you were, you know, looking for a Black midwife, you couldn't find one, what were you finding? What was the midwifery environment like? Who were the midwives? Who were they attending? What was the community kind of response to midwifery at that time?
Well, Oregon's a great state for midwifery. It's a very, it's a state that really supports natural medicine. So I believe they have the first naturopathic and probably one of the best naturopathic schools here. They have an acupuncture school here, massage school, and midwifery has been legal here for a long time. So they had a good midwifery group. And so they had plenty of white midwives, and it wasn't a problem, but they had no Black midwives. And the other thing about this is that Oregon is a huge state and is only 2.5 to 3% African American people in the entire state. Mm. So definitely you don't see yourself.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, so that was it. But the white midwives were open also to, you know, helping out.
Okay. And what were some of the trends in birth happening? Was there a significant group of women having home birth at the time? Since, you know, midwifery had already been legal for a while. There were midwives who were practicing. Were you seeing other people having home births? Were there other any, did you happen to see any other Black families having a home birth?
No.
Okay. Did you see a community of white women having home birth at the time?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So tell me a little bit about starting ICT. So you started it in 1991. You saw this need to bring together not just Black midwives here in the U.S., but Black midwives from around the world. And
right.
Tell me, what was it like? Was it pretty easy to get started? Were you able to recruit a group of other Black women who could help you make this possible? Did you feel like you were doing it on your own?
Right, right. Well, what I want to say, like, is I have to always remember my sisters who work in concert with me. So as I was saying, there are other groups, Mayafa, I don't know if I said the name right or not. There was a small group in Atlanta. They were doing something. Mm-hmm. Then Ayanna created a national group called CPAD, which is on the timeline. That's why we created the timeline, because nobody knows all the work that was happening around midwifery from 19 or even 1920 up. So Ayanna Day created the CPAD, Childbirth Advisors of African Descent. And these were Black midwives who met around the country in different people's houses. That's how I met them. I heard they were in New York. Me and Majita drove up. I was pregnant with my third child at the time. I think I was 8 months pregnant, 7 months pregnant. In fact, they used me as their model. They were teaching something, and I volunteered my body. So, and he was born in 1982. So that went around, that did good for a while, and we even had a newsletter that was going out. But Ayanna was running that program on her credit card, like out of her own pocket and without any team or staff. And we were young, not realizing how much it really took to do it. Mm-hmm. She was kind of doing it by herself, and eventually kind of just slowly stopped. And we talked like, you know, we got to get CPAD back. And, you know, I hate to see it go, and we couldn't get it back. So when I moved to Portland, I called her and said, listen, I'm going to take, and people in Boston told me to like keep doing something. So I called and said, you know, Ayanna, I want to create another organization that's going to be bigger, that's also going to include what CPAD was about. So she said, let's do it. And so I thought of the name, International Center for Attritional Childbearing. I used the same logo
from Boston, which quick story, I'm walking down the street. This handsome African-American guy is walking by me with chit chat. He tells me he's an artist. I said, you know, I'm a midwife and I'm creating a organization in Boston called Traditional Childbirth. I cannot think of a logo. And then he asked me for my address. And then one day I got a letter and inside was a logo. Amazing. It had two hands holding a baby. Have you ever seen the ICTC logo?
Yes,
that,
I have.
That came from Boston. And then somebody here added some, like a Dinka African design to kind of expand it. It was just circled the baby with the two hands and the cord.
Yes.
So that's how we got the logo. But then, so I decided, well, let me just create another nonprofit and we'll make it international this time so we can be inclusive of the Black African diaspora. And so it really was like, there was not a lot of people involved. It was kind of just me in my basement. In the meantime, by the way, I got married. I was married when I came here, got divorced and remarried my husband. We've married now for 18 years, Mikel Shabazz, my honey bun. So he always laughs because he's so when I had to marry him, I stopped doing ICTC in order to win him over. So that took a while, literally. So once I married him, I got back to ICTC. He said, I had no idea who you was or what you did because you didn't do anything like that. I was like on the go, on the computer, praying people in the house, talking midwifery. But I just had gave all my attention to him. And then so he was, you know, he was moved by the commitment, what was going on. So he said to me, so I registered the name, just me. I registered the name and there was no board of directors or anything just yet. And then I had some friends and none were midwives because remember, there's no Black midwives here. Yes. So I had to find people who just believed in what I believed in, was willing to put their name down as board members, which they did. And we did small things like, you know, we got a March of Dimes grant and we did childbirth classes and we did outreach on breastfeeding and those kind of things under the name of the organization. And then he asked me one day, what do you really want to do? And we had not had a gathering of CPAD. We never had a conference. We would have retreats. Like we met in Jamaica with CPAD and hung out and talked and did workshops, visited the Jamaican hospital, talked to Jamaican midwives. I said, I want to put on a Black Midwives and Heals conference because that had never been one. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay, I'll help you. And that's how it began. He and I basically in our basement with four other women, one down the street who worked at Kaiser Permanente, another woman who kind of like took in homeless people who I knew. She was our board chair, by the way. Mm-hmm. And a few other women, we just started meeting. And then my husband has a lot of contact. He talked to somebody to help us get a hotel. And then, you know, everyone I know is brilliant. So I had all my speakers, you know, Ayana's going to speak, Afu was going to speak, you know, Tanya Chemist. I knew, since I had already been a midwife for 16 years, I knew all the midwives. I just called them and said, hey, need you all to present on something. My daughter made the sign. She's like 10. She's an artist. She made a sign. She was so upset. I think her D was backwards. So we had a friend. It was back. Big sign. She had cut the letters out. By the way, Bukele Johari, she's a bridal designer right now. But yeah, she made our first sign. And these two white guys got involved. And they flew in Edna Adan. If you don't know Edna Adan, look her up. She is amazing. Out of a nurse midwife out of Somaliland. Not Somalia. Somaliland. They fought Yeah, she flew in and she was one of our key speakers. And Billy Avery came as our keynote speaker. And Jewel Crawford, physician, Linda Moore, an obstetrician. It was great. We had African dance. It was, you know, in fact, when you watch Bring the Spirit, you see that first conference is in that film.
Yes. So, Bringing the Spirit is a documentary. It's about an hour long documentary about midwifery in this country, especially particularly focusing on Black midwives. And it has a lot of clips of the 2002 first Black Midwives and Healers Conference.
Yeah, you see, it was an amazing event.
Yes, so you see all the legends, as I would call them.
Yeah, I know, all the heavies.
I'm still trying to get Miss Afua on the podcast. Miss Afua has the birthing place down in Houston.
Yes, yes, so, get her.
So that first Midwives and Healers Conference happened. It was a huge success. You had all these people come in and just celebrate midwifery at the time. Tell me what happened after that. How did things go after that? Did you feel like there was momentum built? Was that kind of the peak? What do you feel happened after that time?
Well, I want to say too, we were also going to the white conferences. You know, we had the ACNM and the MANA and they were fine, but even still we wanted to have our own. It wasn't like we couldn't go someplace. We wanted to have one that really, where we were the majority speakers, or all the speakers for that matter, and you know, Black National Anthem. And so that 2002 Black Midwives and Healers Conference put ICTC on the map. Because when you advertise around the world, you're having a conference, everybody knows who you are now. And then they're calling saying, like, okay, who are you? What do you do? We're looking at the website. We're looking at the mission statement. And then on top of that, you got, you know, 50 people, 75 people going back to their city saying, oh, my God, this was amazing. I'm so inspired. And so it was like amazing. It was like wildfire. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody was excited because it was, like I said, for us, by us, and about us. And that's what mm-hmm. we need. How are we going to save our community, not just in from our talent, but as I always mentioned, you know, our relationships with our men, our children are being hurt, you know, just all of it. And how are we going to get the Black community to understand that midwifery is our birthright?
Yes.
And it's the solution to what we're going through. And we should be using midwives first and foremost. And we should be increasing our numbers of midwives. I think from the conference, more people want, in fact, people came saying, I came because I want to be a midwife and I don't know any Black midwives and I don't even know where to start. And that's why I'm here.
Yes. Wonderful. Wow. You mentioned, and I want to just share it for everyone else. You mentioned the Black National Anthem, which is what many people call the song Lift Every Voice and Sing. If you right. don't know that song, you can look it up and listen to it. It's a really amazing song. I know you guys also sang I don't know what you call it, but I Love right. Being a Midwife.
Yes, yes.
And I don't know if in the clip or in some of the clips when you watch the documentary, you see everyone sing that song, but that's another song that a lot of midwives sing, especially African-American midwives. And it's just really, really wonderful to hear if you haven't heard of it.
And I'm going to say that Billy Avery gave us that song at the conference. She sang it for us. And that's what he says, singing with her. She taught us that day. So technically, I would say at that time, it was the ICTC anthem.
Oh, okay. Okay. I didn't know that.
Yes. That's where it came from. That's why it's so important that we record our history, because things happen. And people just think, like, I hear it being sung all over the world. Most recently, I saw a Instagram or YouTube, and they're singing it in Malaysia, which is nice. And they said, deep down in my soul, and the midwives touched their shoe. And someone said, someone please tell me, we talk about the soul of the body, not the soul of the foot. Isn't that something?
I had no... When you said that, I was like, I'm wondering what she's getting at, like touching the soul of the... Touching their shoe. What does right. that mean?
Deep down so, in my foot.
Oh, no, they think like down into your shoes.
I guess. No. Or maybe they believe the soul is in the foot. I don't know, but definitely not what we do as African.
No. We're talking about deep inside your being.
Right, right. Deep, deep, deep down in my soul. I love being a midwife. Deep down in my soul.
Yes.
Say deep, deep, say down, down, say deep down in my soul.
Yes.
And we sing that same song. And so at the same time, you know, I'm leaving a lot out because we did so much, not just with the we did a lot of political work. You know, we're talking mm-hmm. about systemic racism in the midwifery profession, and it's still in it, by the way. It hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm. That's
and so
yes.
having to address issues, because we became like a voice for midwives. So even the nurse midwives came to our conferences, the lay midwives, the judicial midwives, the CPM, because that was the neutral space that we didn't care what your educational track was, is based on how you identify with race. So if you said that yes. you were a Black midwife, we had the exact same experience. So hearing what Black midwives, who nurse midwives, you know, not getting jobs, you know, just how they were treated. So we had a chance to talk with the presidents of ACNM as a body with the Black nurse midwives and talk about how they felt things were going for them and see where we can make the changes, you know, talking to MANA's, board directors, you know, how we could see the changes, you know, talking to the white midwifery schools, that's what we have majority. And still to this day, I mean, we're just really finally getting some different things going. We do have Jenny Joseph's school, but back then there wasn't. So we're just, you know, having to make access for Black women or men or people who wanted to access it but couldn't. So we were that voice and we would call up and have these conversations and they were effective.
But it
wasn't easy.
Yeah. I wanted to touch on something really quick. You said there are barriers for Black women who want to get into midwifery, and they've existed for a long time, and they still exist. And I hear a lot of times they talk about the financial barriers, and they kind of paint this picture as if all Black people don't have money to attend to school, and that's why they don't get to school. But as someone who is in school currently as a Black student midwife, I can speak from my own experience and say that the barriers are not – solely related to finances. That is actually a barrier for multiple different races and ethnicities of people. But
Right. Something
that I've seen is that there's this culture of inclusion, and it's like a sorority among the white midwives. And there's a culture that they all kind of relate to, and they all kind of agree upon. And if you come from from outside of that culture, and something that's really important, I think, to recognize is that midwifery in this country has also been able to proliferate in the most recent years among white, hippie, middle, upper income women. And if you don't come from all of those aspects and identify in this way, and they're also very liberal as well. And something you've touched on, Ms. Sophia, is that a lot of Black women feel called to midwifery in a spiritual or religious way. And so to be a part of a community of midwifery and a training where they exclude that part of yourself, the faith, religion, or spirituality of it, your Black culture or your community, that can be a barrier to your education. I was wondering if you wanted to talk about that a little bit.
I mean, you just did it. You did a great job. And I agree. And thank you for saying that, because it's never about the money. You know, we know that's the minor part. It's first of all, just getting in, you know, our essay, you know, how we apply, accepting our doula training from our community, you mm-hmm. know, those kind of things. I remember my daughter in the fifth grade, she didn't get a good grade on her summer report. I had to go talk to this teacher because it was a good paper. I said, you know what? I said, our kids don't go away and go sailing necessarily or skiing. You know, we have family reunion. We go to Alabama. And so ask her questions about what she does. And don't assume mm-hmm. that we're doing what you and your community does. So she thanked me for that. So those are some of the things, like not just understanding the isolation that Black midwives feel. Like you said, reading books that are derogatory. Yeah, the Black granny midwife. You know, so who wants to sit there and hear about how they're trying to downplay certain parts of your culture, or that, oh, yeah, Black babies have infant mortality, but not saying the reason.
Mm-hmm.
So I always do my presentations that, you know, we may have high infant mortality, but it's not because we're genetically inferior, it's because of the systemic racism that affects the community through the plan problems, plan that there's no food, so plan that there's schools that don't have toilet paper. So I do think what you're saying, you know, the exclusion and the expectation, and even the bias that teachers have, not knowing it, you know, that's mm-hmm. what the implicit bias is, how they look at you and expect you, or how they let some other students, whether it's an extension on the paper or given the right book to read, is that really happening for the Black student?
Mm-hmm.
And most of the midwife students I've talked to, I mean, some have had good experience, and I've talked to white too, who had horrible preceptors, almost having nervous breakdowns. So we know that it's across the board, but like everything else, it's particularly difficult for us, you know,
to get in to stay in,
and then for me to have Black nurse midwives with PhDs who can't get a job at full scope practice, and that's been a real problem for the last 25 years.
Wow.
That you don't hear yeah. about. They went through all that work and then they can't get placed.
Yeah.
Or trying to find we know there's a shortage of preceptors, but if all the preceptors are white, you're going to lean toward what you're familiar with, which would be a white girl who looks like your daughter.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
So then she's going to get the first call, and the Black woman's not going to, so it's going to be more difficult. So those are some of the things off the bat that I can think of that
make it. And those are current problems. Those are not right. past problems. Just
right.
to clarify, those are current problems that are happening in multiple midwifery institutions, including the one that I go to, where as a Black person, there are things you just simply don't relate to when it comes to other students, or because right. of your particular culture or spirituality or religion, that makes it difficult to get along with preceptors who are not culturally aware.
And really not you, it makes it difficult for them to get along with you correctly. You're the student.
And then the student doesn't have the power, so you don't
right.
really get to choose. So,
right.
Okay, so I want to go on to your starting of the Full Circle Doula training. So that is kind of what you have been most known for, or I've known you in the most recent years to be working on and to have made such a profound impact in the world of doula work. So tell me about how you started Full Circle Doula Training and where you are right now with it.
So in 2002, I began hearing the word doula probably, you know, 1997, 98. And I really didn't think a lot of, like, you know, who needs a doula, because the kind of midwife I was and the kind of midwife that I had read about, which was the 20th century African midwife, though she was a midwife, she had doula quality, such as mm-hmm. cooking the food and cleaning the house and rubbing your body and coming back to your house and talking to your families. I thought all midwives did that. I'm finding out now that I don't know how many midwives are still doing that. I know that with Majida and I, we did that. We came in, we cooked, we cleaned, we brought food, we changed your bed, you know, we did everything for you. And so then we did know that the mother during that time, because the doula is the real, really was your mother, and she was equipped because she had her own self, you know, 7 to 9 kids, or even more back in those days. People had big families, so of course she had experience of what to have, what to do, and she could take care of her daughter. And that mm-hmm. should be the ideal person. I mean, I feel like doulas are for people whose mothers can't come. At the MANA conference, there was a young Indian woman with her husband, her little baby. She told me both parents came from India to take care of her. Both sets. There's 4 people in the house. And they went through the whole ritual. You know, they have a very strong ritual of, I've read about their books, of what they do after the baby's born. Very intense, a real culture of how they take care of you. Very nice. So she was fully looking like a happy woman, you know, with her little baby. I'm not kidding. She was just so beautiful and stress-free. So that's how it should be. It should be the mother and the mother-in-law should know how to do it, because America as a whole has extracted our culture as women first and foremost, and then for Black women took everything out, because from my reading, when they took the Black midwife out of our community, it was a devastating time period, because she was the keeper of what the traditions were, and she helped the mother take care of her daughter, and the mother helped the midwife take care of her daughter, and it was a team thing, you know, each one mm-hmm. knew what to do. So when I read about that, I really didn't think a lot of the doula, to be honest, and then I didn't like the word, you know. Slave. Well, it really means slave, and I'm told that even the Greeks don't like the word. But anyways, it's the word doula, and it has a purpose. So, but when I saw that, you know, the kind of thing that I always look for with this deficit in our community, where there's gaps, where there's a need, and so I saw there was no need being fulfilled for Black women to be doulas that reflected our culture, mm-hmm. and so I created the SMC. Back then, it was the ICTC Full Circle Doula. It says, it has always said, built on the legacy of the 20th century African-American midwife. So that's the kind of, you know, we're trained to serve as helpers or servants the way that she did. We don't catch the baby, you know, maybe don't do the blood pressure, but the whole concept. But also, it was a historical aspect of it, too, besides, you know, the actual, and it has evolved in the last 70 years, for sure. We, you know, every training, I see another part to add to it. But the foundation is like, who was the Black midwife? Who are we as healers? You know, how do we serve our community? So the training is built on that. Mm-hmm. What I love about it is that full circle, again, looking at the midwife, she doesn't just do the birth. She does both. She's the labor support, the praying support, the birth support, and she's the postpartum support and the postnatal. So our training covers all that. You're not a birth doula. You're not a postpartum. You're full circle. Full circle means that you do the whole scope.
Yes.
So all in 30 hours. And I did that for one, because we didn't have the time as a people or the economics to go back twice. Yes. Pay $500 now and $400 later for the other one, you know.
Yes.
Because it's not for us to get away with our schedule, even to do one or the other. So I wanted to make it easy all at once. I created it for the working Black mama. So it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It's been like that for 17 years. When we do the survey, they change the dates. They always say no. They would like it longer. Like, no, but we're glad it's like this. So they coming on Thursday at 4:00, which means you haven't missed Thursday. You can cut your lunch and get an hour off, come in early. Call in sick or take your vacation day on Friday and hopefully get childcare on Saturday and Sunday. And then you're done.
Yes.
And it's also, besides just, you know, learning how to serve women and families, it's also creating community and sisterhood, because that's a big issue for us in our community. Like, how do we reconnect as Black women? You know, mm-hmm. How do we work together? How do we do this work with all of our different avenues in life? You know, some are Christian, some are Muslim, some are, you know, Baha'i, whatever they might be. Some come mm-hmm. from working class parents. Some come from rich parents. Some come from single parents. Mm-hmm. But still, we have this thing in common. So really, I've seen it build a sisterhood. So that we can, you know, and how do we learn who we are and have pride? So, and the other thing about the program, it was designed to increase the number of midwives, which is why we sing every day, I love being a midwife. Right. We did add, I love being a doula, but we learned the midwifery philosophy of care. And we learned that our clients should be referred to a midwife. So what we're doing is increasing capacity so midwives will get more clients from their community or more Black clients. And also it means that more women will become midwives, because we did the studies with our, evaluation on the end of the day. They come in like, oh, I don't want to be a midwife. You know, I don't know if I would use one or not. And on the last day when we do the evaluation, 99% said they would use a midwife if they ever got pregnant again. And about, you know, I trained 20 people, at least three to five said they would become a midwife. So
wow,
3 to 5 with 2,000 people for the last 17 years, a lot of people into midwifery.
Absolutely.
And I want them to go to midwifery knowing what they learned, that, hey, we had our first midwifery school. We are called midwifery. It's spiritual for us. It's much bigger than just me and the woman. We are about the family. Mm-hmm. We touch. Yeah, we use grease. We beautify. We fuss over women. We pray over women. We mm-hmm. give our opinion, you know, a lot of different things. So all that is in the training. So it's been beautiful. I'm very happy. We're now, we have 2 trainers. We're expanding our trainers. We're going to have more trainers next year.
Wonderful.
I want to say, I believe we're the oldest Black-owned doula training in the country. There's other doula training, but they weren't Black-owned. Mm-hmm. You know, they had either a white executive, a white board, Black staff, but this is a Black woman, a Black company, even with ICTC that opened this. I don't think anyone can say that they're a Black nonprofit that opened up, or a Black business that opened up a doula training program, and we're the oldest. So I do want to put that out there with pride.
Wow. That's amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I got to attend the ICTC doula training, full circle doula training. You weren't in my instructor. I wish you would have been, but it's okay. I took it in Oakland, and I loved that it was Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Like you said, it felt like this long weekend. I actually wish it was longer as well. But it did. It felt like a sisterhood. It felt like a unifying way. I appreciate that you mentioned the diversity of Black women in this country, religiously, ethnically, mm-hmm. just all of that, but mm-hmm. that we can still unify in this specific way, which is, is so important to recognize and to point out. The other thing I wanted to point out for people who are not familiar with the midwives model of care that Ms. Shafia is talking about, the midwives model of care is a way of serving women throughout the childbearing year. And that's according to MANA, which is kind of like what many people like to go to find out about midwifery in our country. So it's about individualized education, counseling, prenatal care, a continuous hands-on assistance during childbirth and labor, minimizing technological interventions, and then also identifying and referring when it might be appropriate for someone to go on to obstetric care, so a higher level of care. But the midwife's model of care also really aligns with many of the things that Ms. Shafia is talking about that happen within the full circle doula training. It's this idea that support should be all encompassing. It should completely surround the person and their family. It's not just an event that's happening or a medical event that's happening in the person's life.
Thank you. And also I want to say too that, you know, I know the Black midwife and even with the American Midwifery Model of Care is that we believe and tell them that you are okay and that you can do this. You know, we don't see pregnancy as an illness. We don't see birth as a scary, oh my God, it's like, oh girl, please, you know, this is God's work. They would say, you can do this. And that's what women did, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So last thing I want to ask you about, well, I'm going to ask you to share a little bit of your wisdom, but the last thing I want to talk about as we talk about the timeline of ICTC is the transfer from ICTC being the International Center for Traditional Childbearing to it becoming the National Association to Advance Black Birth. What stimulated that change? What prompted it? And how do you see the work that it's doing currently?
Well, I can't say a lot about it. Once I retired as CEO after 17 years of living and breathing the International Center for Traditional Childbearing with myself and my family and all those around the country, it was time for me to move on. You know, it was time. I got a spiritual sign that I was supposed to move on, and I let the board know. Mm-hmm. And they took it on. You know, they took it on in 2016, and they kept it ICTC. And so I was not consulted or talked to about why they were going to change the name. I found it with everybody else. Okay. So I really all I can say is that the women who are on the board, I personally chose them because I felt that they, and they came on board with ICTC. They loved what ICTC stood for. They loved me. I loved them. And so I think that I trust them. Whatever decision they made it in the best interest of what it's going to take for their capacity of saving Black babies and advancing Black birth. So, and I know that a lot of nonprofits, when the founders move on, often they change their name and their direction to a certain extent. I look at Billy Avery with, it was called the Black Women's Health Collective in Atlanta. And when she stepped up, I have to say step up, not step down. She stepped up as I stepped up. mm-hmm. it became the Black woman's health imperative. It's down in Washington, D.C. It went from Billy Avery going, that's why she, if you look up, she's very well known. She started this whole movement in the South where she would go into people's kitchens to get them to get a cervical cancer test. The cervical cancer was very high in the Black community, that particular area in Atlanta. And she created the Black Women's Health Collective to reduce cervical cancer successfully, so much so that she got the MacArthur Award, which is the Genius Award.
Yes.
And so then she moved on and, you know, the board took it. They took it from Atlanta to Washington, D.C., and it's been a different thing, and it's still going, but they do different things. So sometimes it happens.
Okay.
Yeah, so in this case. And I would just want to encourage people that, you know, or you, I think that NAB would love to hear from people who took the training, who've been involved, who have a vision, and to see. I think we have to help our nonprofits out. I know that ICTC needed help and got help, and most of these organizations are doing good work, grassroots without a lot of budget money. And I do think that, you know, Black nonprofits, in fact, I don't think it's been proven that Black nonprofits are the least funded of organizations. I remember writing grants so much, you know, trying to find money to keep things going. When you talk about Black midwifery as an agenda, you talk about empowering Black women and men to take ownership. And when you said that Black midwives rock and we got this great ancestry, they don't fund you for that. Mm-hmm. They want to say that, oh, you know, we down and out and we all got HIV and we're killing each other. I need a grant. I'm not gonna lie about it. So therefore, it was really hard. And I'll be honest, to thank God for the SMC Full Circle Doula, because that's what kept our organization going. We were able to make money and have unrestricted funds to keep the organization not wealthy, but at least functioning. Because
yes.
We were not getting, and we were writing grants like crazy, and they would not fund what we were talking about.
Yeah. I do want to take a moment and just highlight what you just said, because I haven't shared a lot on the podcast about my background and who I am, but I grew up living part in the United States and part overseas. I come from a family that traveled a lot through the military. And I grew up being really proud to be Black and being African-American and looking the way that I did. I did not realize a lot of the story and the rhetoric around what it meant to be a Black American woman. So when I moved back here to the United States as an adult and began to navigate life, I navigated life with that same confidence, the confidence that you're talking about the rich history of being a African-American midwife and the things that we can do and just our resiliency. And in the most recent future, especially as I applied to midwifery school and I've been navigating midwifery school, I have found what you said just now to be so true, that when you share about yourself in this positive light and how empowered you feel and how powerful, really not empowered, but how powerful that you feel and how intelligent you are and the changes and the work you've already done and how really a grant or some kind of support in the work that you're doing is not really a way to be a step up or a crutch. It's just another thing to help you along the way. I felt that I don't get the help that I need, or I don't get the support. It's right. Only when I'm willing to tell them a story that paints me in a really bad light, that says right. I come from this really impoverished background where I've right. been beat down my whole life. And I'm the only one in my family to ever pursue an education or to start right. a business. Only when I am willing to say those things about myself and my community, am I honored and respected or offered, not even respected, because that's not respect.
Right.
Only then am I offered an opportunity or given money or a grant or whatever it might be seen. And that was really hard for me to understand. And that was something that I'm still struggling with and freaking out how to navigate, because it's just not the full truth. You know,
it's not the truth. Everyone is not, you know, when white Appalachian and, you know, poor white people have issues, they don't have to play themselves bad. That's what white privilege means.
Mm-hmm.
I'm drip poor. My father was on meth. You know, my mother walked out, and they don't have to say all that. They just still get their grant because they need the help.
Yeah.
You know, and we have to all be a vulnerable population and at
yes.
risk and all these words. I know my daughter said, I applied for something, but I didn't get it because on every box, I couldn't cross it off. Like,
yeah.
you know, two parents, you know, educated, has a house. Like, she couldn't cross it off. And it's not fair that, because even if you, though you have good education, we're doing what we do, we're still being, and I don't say minority, I say that we're still being overlooked in this country as African descent people. So even though I might be doing well economically, I still need support, because you never gave me a reparation. You gave mm-hmm. it to the Japanese. You gave Native Americans their land. They have reservation. They still have land regardless. They have property that belongs to them. I'm hearing about the Bosnians are getting money, the Somalis get money. We never got crap, and we built the country. So that's why we're having a hard time, not because we're not qualified, because you didn't give us the same
step up. You give every single ethnic group in this country comes here. And so because I'm doing well, you still should be able to give me just as much support without me giving a bad picture. Think that everyone's not vulnerable. Everybody's not on drugs. You know, but we don't need to perpetuate that. Yeah, there's some things going on with all the communities, but
yes,
pay me because I'm doing good, dang it.
Pay me because I'm doing good. Exactly. Right. Okay. So I thought it was important to take a moment to highlight that. And so I wanted just to talk about that for a moment.
Thank you. But
now I want to go on and ask for you to share, if you could provide some words of wisdom or advice to current Black student midwives, what would you say? What would you say to us?
That first of all, I'm super, super proud of you all. And I'm so glad that you all are doing this work. I often shed tears in the doula training when I look at those beautiful, you all, you know, you're 30 something, 25, 41, whatever age you might be, you're usually younger than me. I'm just so proud that you all have stepped up to carry on the legacy, because if we don't have the next generation, this will not continue. Mm-hmm. And I want you to tell you all that, you know, don't, I want to say kick butt, don't take names, but however this expression goes. But, you know, stand strong, stand tall, and don't let anyone take away your human rights to pursue what you want to do with your life around midwifery. You know, and defend, like you mentioned, you know, that we come from a very proud ancestry. You know, life began in Africa. And just like, you know, stand up, be proud. I would also say, when it gets rough, you know, speak your truth to the class. And don't be shy. Tell, you know, call your teacher aside, tell what you have to say in the classroom. And then try to find somebody, if you can, personally or by phone, find a support person that you can talk to, because you do have to get it out. You know, the stress is hard. It's hard being a student as it is, but to be a student where you feel invisibility or discrimination or straight racism, and whatever, all those you want to say that we experience, it doesn't have to be the N word. It's like the look, not covering something, going over to ask somebody else something. This, all the things that we experience in this country, it is very real and it is very stressful. And what I don't want us to do is become the ones that, you know, we're the ones, or you all the ones, are more prone for infant mortality because you're in those stressful, toxic environments. Mm-hmm. So do self-care. And I think finding Black women who are either sympathetic and support you, or students, whether it's a Facebook group, you know, a group meetup, call a friend, you know, meet someone at their house, not at a coffee shop, go sit on someone's couch, plan to be there for 5 hours, you know, and talk about it and get it out. And also, too, I want to say that I have learned that they say the Asians do well because they study together. And they said years ago that Black children tend to study. It might be different, but years ago they said Black children tend to study by themselves. Mm-hmm. So we do need to form study groups, you know, find how we can read the same books, whatever you all are studying across country. Share notes like others do. Share notes, help each other out, and enjoy learning.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ms. Shafia. Before we wrap up, tell us about Shafia Monroe Consulting and Birthing Change, because that's currently the project you're working on, correct?
Yes. So when I moved from ICTC, I opened up a company which has my name, and I do consulting. Mainly my goal, what I've seen with the maternal mortality rate, the discrimination against Black women entering the midwifery field, or Black people, and all of it, a lot of it has to do with cultural competency. And I do know that there are good intentions out there with people. They do want to know what to do, but some people have never seen a Black person. I'm in Oregon, so I know it's true. The dogs bark at me. I'm not kidding. And I see little children move away, like, oh, okay, obviously they're not from the city. So they need cultural competency. So I offer a cultural competency for healthcare providers built on a midwifery maternal child health platform. So the workshop is called Cultural Competency Training, Working with Diverse Populations in Maternal and Child Health. So I go to hospitals and I train midwives, doulas, and OBs and labor delivery nurses, like the five competencies that come out of Columbia University's medical school's curriculum for cultural competency, combined with some other strategies. And then I still have the doula training. ICTC board at the time felt that since I founded it, that I should, you know, take it, which I was happy to do. But of course, I had to change the first three initials from ICT to SMC. So it's the exact same curriculum, the exact same training, the exact same trainer right now, me. So I'm still doing that all over. That's really going. We did, like, I think close to 14 trainings. So it's getting more and more popular, which is exciting. And then I do webinars. So I do webinars on cultural competency online. I do a wonderful webinar called The Art of African-American Postpartum Care, which I love. I'll be doing that again pretty soon. We have a e-newsletter. So if you have not joined it, go to www.shafiamonroe.com, right-hand corner, and subscribe. And it's a free e-newsletter, and you will get a gift. So check your email, your spam, your junk. It's going to be a pamphlet of postpartum herbs and tinctures that we made up that you can,
wonderful.
So you can, that's your free gift. And then just to know what we're doing. And we are planning on doing a Black doula retreat, coming up. And I'm
lovely.
Where?
It'll probably be in Oregon, to be honest, but only because I live here for the first one before I start rotating it.
Okay. So, Tara, tell us where we can connect with you online outside of this. And then where will you be next? Because you're traveling all the time. You were just at the MANA conference. I know you're wrapping up, getting ready to go do something else. Where can we find you next? And then where can we connect with you online?
Okay, well, I'm going to be in Philadelphia on the 5th. And the reason I'm excited about that, I'm being awarded the Dr. Poindexter Award, who's an African-American physician. Mm-hmm. So this is the American Public Health Association. I'm receiving the 51st award. So that's been given to a lot of people. So I'm very excited about that and honored. And I'm being honored for working with and saving the lives, it says, of African descent people. So that was very moving for me.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And then I'll be in Boston doing a dual training. And if you want to take the SMC Full Circle dual training, Tampa, Florida, December 5th to the 8th, there's still some openings. You have to go to the website and you'll see www.shafimo.com. And you can click on Tampa, Florida. And then our number is 503-281-1688. So it's 503-281-1688 to reach the office. And Joyce or Kamari can help you. And then every Wednesday right now, it's called the Wednesday Weekly Chat with Birth Workers. It's going to the second year. So every Wednesday, use it at 12 o'clock p.m. But I cover a topic for 30 minutes. And if you go to the Facebook page, Shafi Monroe Consulting, please like it and follow me and do a review. But you can go to this library of videos everywhere from why SMC Full Circle Doulas Take Blood Pressure. That was a huge controversy.
It has
had so many hits on it, so much conversation. It was amazing. And in the end, I remember one white doula saying at first, like, no, no, no. So as I read and I listened to what she was saying, it's like, you know what? Why not? Like I said, we have to take blood pressure when women are dying from hypertension.
Mm-hmm. Preeclampsia, eclampsia.
Thank you. I had a SMC Full Circle Doula who said on our Facebook group that she had a client that she checked. She did take her blood pressure and it was high. She brought it right in. It was just beginning to become preeclampsia. So it does work for us. It's all co-sleeping, bed sharing, working with teens, the history of Black midwives. So there's tons of videos you can look at on the Facebook page if you're interested. Or join us, you know, and be live with the chat.
Perfect.
Yes.
Ms. Shafia, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Thank you for sharing all of the history that you did and your wisdom with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
I look forward to talking with you again. Is there anything else you want to say before we wrap up?
I just want to say that, you know, the International Center for Nutrition Tribing is a cornerstone, and though it became NAP, it will exist. But I want to encourage everybody listening on this, your platform, and thank you for doing it, who is African descent, you know, to create your legacy. We want more than one legacy. We need more than one legacy, because we all do things differently. We might like ICTC. I might like American Midwife podcast, or I might like Janie Smith's podcast. We need to have options. We don't have to have just one thing. You know, other groups have more than one thing. So we can have more than one thing to help the movement work and still work together. So I just want to say that, you know, create your legacy, you know, be bold, be a leader. We're all leaders, you know, be daring. That's why I like the term birthing change. Every day when we wake up, we have rebirthed ourselves. We have the opportunity to create change. So it's a constant movement of change that's going to make all that we're looking at better, which really is to help all babies have the best start and all families have the best start, and to find ways that we increase capacity in the Black community for midwives and doulas and healers. So I want to end with that.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me to be part of your podcast. You're doing an excellent job. I think what you're doing is very important, and I'm wishing you all the success. Invite me to your graduation so I can clap.
Oh, I love that.
Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Shafia. I'll call you right back.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the American Midwife Series podcast with Ms. Shafia Monroe and myself. the host, Angelica Malone. It was truly an honor to sit down and talk with her and to hear about her journey through midwifery and some of the things she went through and the things she overcame to be the leader that she's become in the midwifery community, and how she's just broken down so many barriers and made space for people to come behind her. I was so excited. I had to contain myself throughout the interview. And I don't know if you could hear that, especially in the beginning, but it was truly an honor to talk with her. I hope you'll share this episode with a friend. I hope you'll also leave a review on whatever podcast recording app that you listen through. By leaving a 5-star review, you make it easier for more people to find this podcast and to learn about these amazing midwives across the United States. It's really important that we begin to share these stories and that we make sure that they don't fade away into the history books. We want to make sure that these midwives, their stories are told. And I also think it's important that we make sure that people who are giving birth around the United States can find a midwife near them. And so this podcast is aiming to do that, aiming to bring to light all the midwives that are serving people throughout the U.S. So please share it with a friend. Please leave a review. And when you leave a 5-star review, you help other people to find this podcast. You can also find me on social media if you'd like to connect with me. You can find me on Instagram. That's probably the app or the platform I'm on the most. And my username is @AngelicaMalone. That's AngelicaMalone. You can also email me, especially if you have a midwife who you think would be a great guest on the American Midwife Series podcast. You can email me at hello@angelicamalone.com. And finally, if you would like to be a guest on the podcast and you're a midwife somewhere around here in the U.S. and you want to bring light to your practice or share about the people you're serving, or you think there's an important theme in midwifery that isn't talked about very often or in student midwifery, please email me and I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you again soon with another wonderful episode with an American Midwife.